My name is Mike Flynn. I'm Director of Government Affairs at Reason Foundation. Thank you for joining us, me today, and this great panel I have. I do want to have a couple ground rules real quick. We've got just over an hour to talk about what Peter Wallison, I think, correctly described as the worst financial crisis of all time. So we're going to have to be brief. I will let my inner fascist out and be very, very strict on time for our panelists here. We are going to have some opening comments from each of us. Then we're going to have a moderated discussion for a few minutes, and then we're going to open up for question and answer. It's as I sit here, I think when we first started planning Reason Goes Hollywood 40th anniversary, nobody would have ever bet that we'd have this subject on the agenda. This is something, what a strange couple months it's been. We've had to put up with a lot from this administration over the last 8 years, but the events of since September, the middle of September, make me actually nostalgic for steel tariffs and prescription drug benefits. And I wish we'd go back to that time that No Child Left Behind was the great injustice we were trying to fight. Because now we're looking at a wholesale takeover of large parts of the economy. I do want to pick up where Peter Wallison, he mentioned and stressed during his lunch address that we are in this place because of the express deliberate government policy. And I think that bears repeating ad nauseum. Because currently the public policy debate is down in this rabbit hole of which regulatory agency failed, which bit of deregulation failed, and none of it failed. There are two things at play here. The first is express government policy to juice homeownership rates. Historically, since the end of the Second World War, we've had homeownership rates around 60%. Through bipartisan action beginning in the 90s, we juiced that up to 70%. That marginal difference between where it's been historically and where it got to is the underlying cause of this problem. There's been a lot of talk about Ben Bernanke and Henry Paulson and Alan Greenspan and George W. Bush, and the entire rogues gallery, they all have a role to play. But I'd like to throw out a new nomination for a villain, a name you probably haven't heard, one of those government apparatchiks who, labor's just beneath the radar and nobody really knows what influence they have. And a gentleman by the name of Richard Syron, who in the early 90s was president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. In 1993, the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston pulled together a summit of housing activists, community activists, mortgage lenders, and put together a report called Closing the Gap. And it was their recommendations for how lenders could expand homeownership in underserved areas. And a lot of the recommendations are very innocuous. There are things like better training for your staff, better marketing to minority and low-income areas. But there are a few things that now, in hindsight, kind of set the stage for where we are now. And included recommendations like, don't worry too much about income levels. It says the poor actually are much better at paying high rates of their income in housing than the rest of the population, which is kind of like water running uphill. Go ahead and loosen up your mortgage lending standards. So this was like the active policy of the Boston Fed. They issued this report. It went out to all the other Fed Reserve branches. And as HUD and federal regulators and congressmen dealt with Fannie and Freddie, this was kind of where they pushed them. And so banks responding to their regulators kind of absorbed these lessons. Now, I mention his name because he left soon after this report. About 1994, he left the Boston Fed. And he resurfaces in our narrative again in 2005 when he's named the head of Freddie Mac. And this coincides with the time that Freddie Mac decides to go on the subprime purchasing binge. And as Peter Wallison mentioned, between Fannie and Freddie, they purchased, close to $2 trillion in subprime mortgages. Richard Syron was right there to lead this effort. So the seeds he sowed in 1993, he was then able to implement in 2005. And that gets us a lot to where we are right now. Now, I should also say, there's also a greed element here. Obviously, Wall Street operates on greed, and thank God they do. We want them to operate on greed. You had a very bizarre situation in which the credit agencies who would evaluate these mortgage-backed securities were paid by the seller of the securities. They were not paid by the buyer of the securities. So you can see where the incentive is to rate those as high as possible, because it's the person selling the securities that pays you. But to say there's greed really doesn't mean anything because normally within the market, the people who are greedy and overreach get punished. The real problem with this bailout is we have interrupted that process. We have said the people who made the mistakes, who maybe acted out of greed, who didn't do their fiduciary responsibility to look at these things, they're not going to get punished. We're going to bail them out. And once we start down this road, as you all know, it's impossible to stop. There is in Washington right now a meeting of all the leading mandarins from around the world who are getting together to figure out what more we can do to prevent this crisis and to cure this crisis. Supposedly the $700 billion was going to fix it. That didn't fix it. They've changed what they're doing. Now we're on the auto companies. We're going to go into a lot of other industries now. So, I mean, we've crossed a Rubicon. I don't know how we go back. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, but it's going to require kind of internal vigilance, as we mentioned. Now, I'd like to turn to our panel, and again, just 5 to 8 minutes from each of us, and then we'll have a discussion. First, Véronique de Rougey, senior fellow at the Mercatus Center, who is going to talk, I think, a little bit more about the market's role in this and whether or not it's a market failure and what this tells us about capitalism. So, Vera.
Am I going to talk about that? Really?
Talk about whatever you want.
It's a pleasure to be here. First, let me take a minute to thank David and Bob. You have absolutely no idea what it means to me. If I take a second to think where I am right now for the 40th anniversary of Reason, it's totally surreal. I mean, like 10 years ago when I left France, you know, I was like this lone libertarian. I would have never imagined that I would have been here today. So, you know, thank you very much. I would have not imagined either that the U.S. would have become like France suddenly, and maybe I have some responsibility in that process. I mean, I've been a budget analyst for 7 years, and under my watch, the federal budget has grown by $1.3 trillion. I've always been surprised that my employers have never blamed me for it, but obviously I've done something wrong. So anyway, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I wanted to go back to, obviously, you know, a lot has been said. We know this is not the lack of regulation that's put us here. But I want to actually step back a little bit and try to think of where maybe we failed as a community, maybe not the free market community, but certainly where I failed as a free market economist. And I've been around. I worked at Cato. I worked at AEI. Now I'm at Mercatus. So where have I failed maybe somehow in this process? And I think that one of the things we failed to do is to actually systematically point out in the last 20 years, 15 years, 10 years, that what we have right now is not capitalism. What we have right now is political capitalism. The world we evolved in is not an unhampered economic market. It's a totally, you know, in a market where there's massive government intervention. And I think we have failed to actually point out that simple fact and to just, you know, say each time something was like, even now, like when you hear about how on deregulation and the lack of regulation is responsible, that we should have been saying things like a long time ago. So I think right now one of the things that we might want to do as a community is like each time we can, you know, in our private life, in our, you know, in our professional life, each time we can, we need to actually go back to first principle and be as strong as we can, and we have nothing to fear, right? I mean, we can actually state the facts because the truth is on our side, and maybe we have failed to actually make that case strong enough. But more importantly, I think one of the things that we need maybe to do once doing this is maybe rethink our political alliances. And as an economist, again, one of the things that I tend to think is like I have a natural alliance with the Republican Party. And it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. And I think, you know, I failed. I mean, certainly I've been a critic of the Republican Party for years, but I think I still irrationally have this feeling that, you know, they're more free market than the Democrats, when in fact, we've seen it. You know, we've seen it's completely untrue. Or either it is that the Republican Party just has, you know, led us to believe that they were free market and we were the idiots to believe it, or they're in fact, they're not, and we should point it out and have no fear to actually show them, you know, that they're like, you know, speak out and say and denounce them. Another thing, like, think about the fact that we were as a community all like, you know, really high on the fact that Greenspan was at the Fed. You know, Greenspan, on top of that, had the perfect veneer of this great free marketeer because, you know, he was a follower of a Rothbard and Ayn Rand and said he believed in the gold standard. And yet his entire career has been built around actually doing exactly the opposite of what he supposedly philosophically believes. So I'm just here to kind of, you know, say that I think as a community we do have, and certainly I do have a responsibility, and we need to absolutely rethink, you know, rethink our I mean, go back to first principle and also rethink our political alliance and denounce people who claim to be free marketeers when they're not. And there's just a lot of that to do, and we have our job cut for us right now. Oh, thanks. That's it. You.
Wow. You're on time. Our next speaker is recent contributing editor Tim Kavanaugh. And as our reflexive contrarian, I have a question for you because, you know, a lot of this talk was not that we were bailing out Wall Street, but that we were doing this so that Main Street would not collapse and that this would spread to Main Street and shut down the Main Street economy. Your thoughts on that?
I had the distinct honor this year of meeting both Senator Clinton and then Senator Obama. Both of whom I was interested to note, unbidden, talked about moral hazard, and this was all in the context of talking about the proposed bailout. This was early in the year, but we were already in bailout season at the time. And, you know, that's encouraging in a way that they're at least willing to use that phrase, but I really think moral hazard is an argument and is a concept that has been really underrated and underplayed. And still is, because, I mean, this is a bailout that's brilliantly, ingeniously designed specifically to punish the just and reward the wicked. And when we talk about Wall Street versus Main Street, which I want to we'll get to that in a second, but you know, we had, I'm going to talk craziness for a second and say that what the market has been doing, what the market was doing beginning, you know, in 2007, was basically what it's supposed to be doing. There was not some terrible, I mean, there might be terrible things going on. It certainly might be ugly for the same reason that a yard sale is ugly. That what we needed to be doing was getting rid of bad debt, shedding people who were not good borrowers, and letting the incompetent fail. That's been going on, and it's going to continue to go on because there's only so much intervening you can do in an economy. The economy is basically going to go where it wants to go. Right now, as we saw at lunch, house prices are twice what they were 10 years, just about twice what they were 10 years ago. As a function of your income level, of median incomes, you know, they're far out of whack with where they were 10 years ago, much further out of whack than where they were 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and so on. You know, in 1978, I believe the median house price was about twice what the median income price, average, you know, income price for the country. So, you know, what prices want to do right now is fall. And if we're interested in affordable housing, as everybody seems to be, that's where you want them to go. We have sort of internalized this idea that if prices start falling, and this is the price of an underlying asset on which, you know, huge Rube Goldberg contraptions of, you know, of debt have been built that even the inventors of them didn't really understand them. The inventors actually aren't around anymore. And so, you know, that needs to fall. Which brings us to Wall Street versus Main Street. I mean, you'll always be able to get elected by saying that you're helping Main Street at the expense of Wall Street. But every single version of consumer debt is up. Credit card debt is up, auto loan debt, mortgages. Everything is seeing massively increased rates of defaults over the last couple of years. There's the problem. I mean, I've actually been thinking I need to get an agent and just pitch a book. All I need is the title, and it would be Nation of Deadbeats, or better yet, Generation Deadbeat. And say, you know, that's what we've got. We have a lot of people who are just bad credit risks, and they need to be gotten out of the system. And we're doing, it's especially galling to me because I've been, you know, when I was still employed by the LA Times, I was using my inflated salary to keep paying down the principal on this white elephant of a house that I don't live in. And now I'm probably about 100K above water on that house. So I'm the guy who got to screwed the worst. I would have been better off just paying the interest every month and being able to go to my lender now and say, oh, poor me, you got to give me a haircut on this house. Now I can. There's nothing I could do. So once again, the just, clearly that's me, are being punished. I think we need to keep sight of the fact that all of this lending and everything we've been talking about with making more, you know, increasing the rate of home ownership and all those sorts of things, we can argue. I think there are interesting arguments to on the side that, you know, home ownership is not necessarily this unqualified good and something that we need to be social engineering our way into. But let's assume that that's good. We still have to say that none of this would have gone south if people had kept paying their loans. And let's just, we can take it up in the discussion further.
Okay, cool. Next, I want to hear from Len Gilroy, who's Director of Government Reform at the Reason Foundation. In a sense, this is kind of a bookend to our discussion. It kind of covers the entire range here, you know, whether we come from how we got here to what's going on right now and what we do about it. Len, you know, who is in the front lines of a lot of public policy debates, and as we, you know, the government puts on trillions of dollars in debt to deal with this crisis, it's going to have an impact in its public policy development down the road. And Len's going to be kind of seeing that firsthand. So some thoughts about how, from Len, about how you think this is going to impact public policy development. And then also, since you are kind of Mr. Sunshine and Light, if you can find perhaps a silver lining in this and what we could look forward to going forward.
Thanks, Mike. It's a great opportunity to be here. I just want to throw that out there, and it's an honor to work for Reason Foundation and to be here on the 40th anniversary. I want to say that first. And I do want to apply a slightly different lens to this this discussion. And from my vantage point, I'd say that the fiscal crunch that we're seeing is really helping to expose what I would categorize as a perpetual fiscal crisis at all levels of government. And the size and scale of this is really truly staggering. You can spend like a drunken sailor in the good days and people don't really pay much attention, but then when everything hits the fan, you see everyone start scurrying. And that's what we've been seeing recently. About a month ago, we saw the governator. He sent the first shot across the bow, hinting at the possibility of a $7 billion bailout for California just to keep the state's doors open. Now, that didn't ultimately go through, but I would imagine with the size and scale of the budget deficit here, you might see that call come back again in maybe a different form. Then about 2 weeks ago, we saw a parade of governors and mayors on Capitol Hill, and they were testifying, asking for a bailout of state and local government. And I do want to acknowledge in that discussion, though, South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, he's also a friend of Reason, he was the only one to testify there that, quote, and this was in the context of an economic stimulus, quote, this $150 billion salve may in fact further infect our economy with unnecessary government influence and unintended fiscal consequences. And then just yesterday, the mayors of three big cities, Philadelphia, Atlanta, and Phoenix, sent a letter to Secretary Paulson asking the feds to use a portion of the $700 billion bailout to assist the struggling cities. Now, so this is a problem that's really grafted on top of and will exacerbate the pre-existing problems that we already had. I'll just throw a couple of numbers out there. The deficit today, the national deficit, we've got it's a record $440 billion this year. It's likely to top $500 billion next year. Today, the national debt is it totals $10.6 trillion. And since 2000, that's increased over 60%. To give a sense of scale on that, just to put some numbers around it, if we were to try to pay off that today, that would cost each and every American well over $30,000. That's each and every one of us. This is a great story. I don't know how many of you saw this, but in September, when the debt actually exceeded $10 trillion, you know that there's that national debt clock in New York City? Well, that actually ran out of digits, and they had to replace the dollar sign with another digit. And So they're going to have a new one coming out with two extra digits
next
year.
Wait, does that
year.
Mean couldn't we just put it into a different currency then? That might solve the problem, right?
Right. And then I would be remiss if I didn't mention the unfunded pensions and obviously Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Just Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid alone, by 2040, if nothing changes, we won't be able to afford anything else than those three things. So, and that doesn't even include public pensions, which is another looming crisis out there. And if you look at the state level, you've got 12 states right now that are looking at well over $1 billion of shortfall today. That's a quarter of the states, and that's just today. That number is going to get worse. City budgets, same thing. New York alone, $2.3 billion in the hole. L.A., Atlanta, many others in that range. And even the transit agency in New York City, they're $1 billion in the hole right now. And about 30 states are in recession. So that's what we're putting this on top of. So what that means, though, and here's sort of I'm getting into the silver lining, is that the two go-to sources of revenue for government, which are taxes and bonds, well, those are going to be very severely constrained moving forward. I mean, the political will to raise state and local taxes is very low. And then analysts on the bonding side, believe that we've pretty much seen the end of the era for relatively cheap money for state and local governments, and that probably we're going to see a municipal bond market like more like what it looked like 10 years ago. So it'll be much more plain Jane, vanilla bonds, higher interest rates, et cetera. So I'll cut to the chase. What that basically means is you've got all these priorities out there and less money coming in to fund them. So here's the silver lining that I'm seeing. And don't despair, fellow travelers here, because I think we have a tremendous opportunity right now to advance market-based policies. And as Reason's privatization director, this is where it becomes really fun for me. The interest in privatization right now is off the charts, and I am busier than ever. Governments are having to scramble to do more with less. And so across the board, regardless of partisan lines, they're increasingly recognizing that privatization is going to be one of those proven tools for doing that, for doing more with less. And we can look at Mayor Daley in Chicago, for example, as maybe an example of the bipartisan nature. Before 2005, he had already privatized some 40 different services and activities in Chicago. And in 2005, he leased the Chicago Skyway for a $1.8 billion check from a investor operator team. And he took that money and set up a $500 million rainy day fund for the city, paid down some of the pension obligations and some other infrastructure investment, etc. Since then, he's gotten $600 billion for leasing 4 downtown parking garages. And then this is a great example here. Right in the middle, on September 30th, right in the middle of all this financial crunch, Mayor Daley announces that he's got a $2.5 billion bid for Midway Airport, and that's going through now. So you've seen one urban leader, Democrat. I would not argue that Mayor Daley is a friend of liberty, but he's a friend of privatization. He's tapped now up to about $5 billion in private capital to help to essentially divest the city of some of its assets that are maybe business or commercial in nature, and he makes the case all the time that government doesn't need to be in the business of business. So he seems to have a very clear sense of that. And Mayor Daley has really launched a trend, and now you see bipartisan state and local leaders out there talking about privatization. And just I want to wrap up with one little piece here. I happened to be at the Republican Governors Association meeting the other day, and it was interesting because the whole discussion there was, well, what does the Republican Party do going forward to kind of, you know, in the wake of the election, et cetera? And Governor Sanford, I have to say, again, was really just brilliant there, because all the people who were saying, well, we need to use the internet better, or, well, we just need to get our message, you know, and really focus on economic policy. And I would argue that they do need to do that. But Governor Sanford said, look, it's not the internet. It's not all these other things. We are not clearly articulating the stakes. And the stakes are exactly what I just described in terms of all the big unfunded liabilities out there and the massive growth in government. So the day of reckoning has really come. But, you know, so in the end, I think the when you ask the logical question, well, who's going to bail out the bailouters and the big spenders? Well, a key piece of that answer is privatization. And so I think Reason's policy work is and will continue and will expand it to be extremely vital going forward. And, you know, it's funny, I had a piece in the New York Post a couple weeks ago where the argument is, yeah, today we may be talking about bailing out these, quote, greedy Wall Street bankers, but who exactly is going to be coming to bail out the bailouters? And it's going to be those greedy Wall Street bankers that are going to be coming to the rescue. We see that in Chicago right now with the bids on all the assets, et cetera, and we're going to see more and more of that. So thank you.
Wow, you almost make it seem like this was a good thing that happened.
I'm a glass half full guy, Mike.
That's some spit. I know spit. Tim, I have a question for you, because up until very recently, you were a card-carrying member of the Fourth Estate. One thing that struck me throughout this entire couple months is the overt cheerleading from the media, which is probably one of the few times you've had the media without question trumpet a Republican administration's policies. It's gotten to where I couldn't even watch CNBC for a lot of times without losing my breakfast. From your perspective and your friends in the media, can you account for that and what that was all about?
I would carve out one important exception to that rule. The left-wing media, and by that I mean the overtly left-wing media, were actually really seriously opposed to this, to all of the bailouts, for reasons that are absolutely true, because a bunch of greedy bazillionaires are getting bailed out at the expense of you and I on Main Street. But it has been, it has been a classic sort of media framing issue, where the package is always described as an economic rescue plan. There are, when it doesn't get past, the characterization of it is not, there was an argument about whether it would actually be effective. The argument was that there are crazy people. There are, ideological zealots in the Republican Party, to their credit, in the U.S. House, who don't want to save America, who didn't want to rescue our economy. They're willing, on the basis of some crazy ideological belief, to let the entire economy go south. The entire economy, as far as I can tell, continues to go south at an even faster clip every time we get these involved. It's been extremely weird to see Henry Paulson, talking about the freeze in the credit markets and all that. Every step he takes seems to exacerbate the problem. And there has been very, very little questioning of that. To the extent that the media cover details of it, there has been a bit of overt salesmanship. I'm thinking particularly of a piece in the LA Times, which we can now make this argument. There may be something to this, but the tenor of the page one above the fold right hand story one morning was, this bailout may end up making a profit, and first of all, that raises a lot of questions that didn't get answered in the article, such as, okay, well, if it makes a profit, what does it become then? Is it a sovereign wealth fund or something where, the natural resource that is the sweat of our brows as hardworking Americans becomes this kind of hedge fund that's run by the government? What does that mean if it makes a profit? And if it is going to be something that makes a profit, maybe it's not worth doing. Maybe it doesn't need to be done. If there's more value in these mortgage-backed securities than we think there is, and there probably is, and we should acknowledge, when we say market failure and the term market failure has been abused, there has been a classic market failure in the sense that all these incentives on Wall Street were set up for reasons including government action, but for other reasons too, that there were various incentives that encouraged everybody to buy these assets, which they can't figure out what the value is. A mortgage-backed security doesn't contain all the information about who are the borrowers, who are the people who bought the house. For privacy reasons, you actually can't figure out what your debt load is in there and what it's worth. That's why they can't price these things. That was a true market failure. That's where you get the leeway to say there may be a profit in this bailout. But get back to the main point. I think the media salesmanship has been really just taking it all at face value. I don't know what's in people's hearts, even in the reporting business, but I think to some extent the reason that people were so willing to, believe something that was, was being proposed by the genocidal maniac George W. Bush is that, in their hearts, they've always wanted to believe that the government had to come in and manage the economy.
Did you read there was a really great article in the Washington Post of all places talking about, actually it was like it's the only one like this I've seen in the media saying actually, well, capitalism is not dead because this is not what we have and this is all government intervention.
Yeah.
That led us there. Did you see that article?
I didn't see it, but
it's 10,000.
Well, but it was the Washington Post.
Right.
Yeah. I was thinking.
That was certainly the article that you didn't see in a lot of places. People have been raising flags about Fannie and Freddie. There was a Washington Monthly story, I remember many, probably 2004, 2003, specifically detailing what dire straits Fannie and Freddie were really headed into. So some people have raised the flag in the media, but and once the bailout game got rolling, it's who knows? You don't really. Sometimes the media really are trying to be objective, and you don't know what point they're trying to get across. I applauded the LA Times when it put out the 7000000 straight across the front page headline, and maybe there was an effort to voice some skepticism, but I don't think the skepticism was ever about do we need to have this bailout. It wasn't really skepticism at all. It was really outrage at look at what Wall Street greed has forced us to pay.
Do you guys think, because Fannie and Freddie, as has been mentioned many times, were so closely identified with one political party, the fact that this all broke right before an election, did that have an impact in people not really probing their role in this whole affair? That, because they didn't want it to see, at a point where they could beat up the Republicans for this mess, they didn't want to expose Fannie and Freddie and their political ties.
The Republicans had 6 years of control of both branches and the White House,
As Peter said, during the presidential campaign, when Obama attacked McCain by saying Republicans put us in this situation, what did McCain say? McCain said, well, I'm glad that now we have this bipartisan solution, right? He didn't actually kind of say deregulation. What are you talking about? It's nonsense. The Republicans were not interested, it seems, I don't know why, either because they were scared of actually talking the truth, or they were scared of the backfiring of actually admitting their own mistakes. They were not willing to actually talk about the fact that, no, in fact, Obama should be really proud of them because they have been big regulators. As Matt said this morning, the spending on regulatory activity, so the amount of money the federal government spends on enacting regulation and enforcing them has increased by 66% in the last 8 years. 66%, 33% under Clinton. And you can actually, credit it to the Republican Congress, but it's actually not the case, because if you just compare year for year with the Republican, completely Democratic Congress and Democratic White House versus whole full-blown Republican Party control, it grows way faster under the Republican. Mm-hmm. While the number of final rules have decreased slightly, the number of economically significant rules, which are the one that cost the economy over $100 million for each one of them, is increased by 70%. 70%. It's massive. So we've had this kind of weird thing during the Republican rule, which was that on one hand, it was costing more to enforce and produce those rules, even though they were producing fewer of them, so we were producing them less efficiently somehow. But at the same time, they were more expensive and costly to the economy, so taxpayers were screwed twice. And McCain just sat there and said, bipartisanship. Isn't that great? I just don't understand where the Republicans, they had this great line. What are you talking about? We're the greatest regulators of all time.
Right.
So,
this actually brings up a question, because as you mentioned, you're a refugee from several think tanks in D.C.
I thought you were going to say from France. Yeah. That too.
And, this is, we used to joke that it looked like we were coming into this era of re-regulation, like that old Fox show, That 70s Show. But this is really like That 1930s Show, what we're doing right now. And my question is, in the last 20 years, we've been told quite often that there's this very robust free market think tank movement, and there's been incredible growth in free market think tanks, and the intellectual background and ammunition for free markets is more than it ever was in the 30s or even the 70s. So what the hell happened?
It's a good question. I think one of the things that just happened. Anyone who knows me knows that I've been really down. I'm wondering whether I should run for the hill and just sort of actually make money if the market wants me, and maybe give money to think tanks, because obviously I haven't been really efficient at doing anything, and wondering whether we had lost the battle of ideas. But the more I think about it, the more I think we've lost the battle of implementation rather than the battle of ideas. At least I hope so. But I think one of the things that has happened is When you're in D.C., when you work in a think tank in D.C., right, I mean, it's actually really hard to be in a libertarian think tank. It's great. It's awesome because you get to tell everyone they're wrong, right? And it was, I mean, it was spectacular to actually be at AEI, which is a phenomenal think tank, being hardcore libertarian and bashing the Republicans all the time. You know, like now I'm scared for my own business. Like, what is it going to be like when the Democrats are in power? Because, you know, I'm just going to be saying what everyone expects me to say, that they are big spenders. But I think that the way the business community has been organized the last 15 years, while we were feeling that, you know, some of the ideas we had definitely won. Like, we thought that there would never be any talk about nationalization. You know, we believed in tax cuts, any tax cut. Milton Friedman told us, right? He's never met a tax cut he did not like. And we were all, like, really high on these ideas. We were, I think, you know, we had to kind of align ourselves with, instead of just saying, like, we're libertarian, we're free market, it doesn't matter who's in power, we're going to be actually criticizing, you know, whomever is being an interventionist, we're going to criticize them. I think we've actually tried, for better or worse, to think of how can we make things change from now. Now that we won the battle of idea, how can we actually try to implement these ideas? And we thought that talking with government was a good idea. And I think that made a lot of us kind of, you know, scared of actually, you know, telling them you're wrong, you know, because we wanted to be invited at the next hearing. And so there's just kind of like these games that were played. And I think it was...
Were we too inside the system?
Maybe too inside the system. Obviously, I've never really been inside any system, but...
I don't believe that.
But yes, it's possible that we kind of, you know, we were a bit too careful in actually calling people names. But it's because also D.C. is organized between Republicans and Democrats. And if you're neither a Republican nor a Democrat, no one really wants to listen to you. So, you know, you have to kind of make it work. And maybe the solution now is just say, you know, screw that. You know, we're neither one, and it's a great thing to be just a libertarian and have no allegiance to anyone.
Well, I think that's where we're at. Whether we want to or not. Len, are there, you know, she mentioned, like, maybe we were too inside the system and, you know, a lot of government leaders kind of failed us here. Are there any, in your work in state and local governments, I mean, are there any leaders out there who get this and are talking against this kind of stuff?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mentioned Governor Sanford from South Carolina. He is he's one of those people who can, unprompted, without you know, sort of a teleprompter, he can stand up and articulate the value and the importance of markets. And you know, he has transformed the budgeting system in South Carolina, for example, where, you know, the typical tendency when you face you know, a several billion dollar shortfall is to say, okay, well, we need to do an across the board cut of, you know, say 10 to 15%, and that'll solve the problem. Governor Sanford, and he's not alone. The state of Washington does this as well. He said, that's the wrong question or the wrong tactic. Let's take a different approach. Let's just wipe the slate clean and start saying, instead of thinking, what do we cut, what's that 10 to 15% we cut, let's instead look at, well, how could we spend the other 85 to 90% more efficiently? So what he did is, in the typical tendency, what you see in government all the time is the belief that the dollar that you spent last year was a good dollar spent, so that's the baseline for next year. There's not an evaluation of, was it really, did we get bang for the buck out of it, did we get results, etc. So Governor Sanford, for example, changed the budgeting model in South Carolina to what you might call priority-based budgeting. They figured out what are the handful, you know, dozen or so things that are the core functions, core services we want to provide. Let's rank them. Let's be out there and transparent with citizens. Let them say, hey, look, we don't have the money, so pick. What of this list of priorities do you guys want? And they, you know, kind of, they start with that premise. And then you can think of it as an inverted pyramid. They fund the sort of the core things that they've identified first. And then when the money runs out, you know that the things that haven't been funded are that, you know, tiny piece of the pyramid or the bottom of the inverted pyramid that, you know, is less of a priority. He would be one. Governor Daniels in Indiana would be another. you see under Governor Daniels' leadership, I mean, he took a state in Indiana that was rapidly driving itself into the economic ground. And within a couple of years, instituted a variety of reforms, and I'll spare you the details on those, but essentially what you have now today is a state that just got its first AAA bond rating in history and is able to deal with some property tax reform issues and some other things. And I think Bobby Jindal also will be another governor to watch. He's already instituted ethics reform and is starting to get into how do they deal with their billion-plus dollar deficit. And so I think you've got a couple of people out there. And then I also mentioned Mayor Daley. So you've got these leaders out there who do clearly articulate it. And the good news is that yesterday Governor Sanford was nominated chairman of the Republican Governors Association. And I heard Bill Kristol from the Weekly Standard say this at that meeting, that he thought the future of the Republican Party now was in the state houses, or excuse me, in the state executive mansions. And I'd have to agree with him on that because, I mean, they're certainly not in D.C. either. We don't have that in the presidency. You don't see that in the Congress. But you do see that you see a couple of leaders in the Republican Party, in the governor's offices, that will be the guys moving the ball forward on fiscal reform, spending, you know, how do we deal with these issues and let's not.
I do have to say, though, I do remember that's what we heard about George W. Bush.
That's very true. The proof is always in the pudding, and that's very true.
But, I mean, actually, I mean, I think it's an interesting question that we face right now. It's like, as libertarians, as, you know, I mean, like, what is the best strategy? I mean, like, the last 8 years, the entire think tank community, free market community, has been poured into the administration, you know, the agencies, you know, Congress, and yet we got probably the worst administration of all time, right? And so I, you know, rather than keep on talking to government officials at any level possible. And I'm not saying there's just one way to go. I mean, is this really an efficient strategy to keep talking to the government over and over again when they fail us systematically? Shouldn't we actually
kind of
be
the battered wife syndrome?
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's like, I think we, you know, I think we should go turn around and talk to the American people. And in fact, like, I read a study last week that was depressing, but actually like gave me, you know, confirmation of what I would have been thinking. It's like, it's useless to talk to government official at any level. Let's talk to the American people. Andrew Schleifer at Harvard, who's actually produced tremendous work on institution and their outcome on the economy and on political outcome, he wrote with a trillion co-author. I don't know, they're like six or seven, and he looked at the impact on the demand for government when there's a decrease in social capital. So when the trust that people have in others or in corporation or in government, when that trust is damaged or decreased, what happens to the demand for government? And they found, and they did a cross-country analysis, that this demand for government increases even when people think that actually the government is corrupted and that the government is ineffective. So I wonder whether what we should really be doing is actually, like, you know, try to actually pamper social capital as much as we can and actually talk to the American people, talk to people so they understand, you know, that demand for government is not necessarily the solution. Because this is what this bailout is about, right? The government fails us and we want more government.
Oh, I have to agree with you on that. I mean, I think there's many pieces of this. And, you know, I think what we need to do as a movement is to really...
And certainly not kind of pamper the Republican Party.
Well, no, I mean, I would agree with you. And I think one of the the challenge, I think, for the free market movement moving forward is to really make markets as attractive as iPods. Because that's who we're talking to. I mean, if you go and have a meeting on Capitol Hill with staff, you know, you're dealing with people who are 25 and younger often. I see this in the state houses all the time, too. You know, we need to get that's just in the political sphere. And then out there, you have a wide swath of the electorate out there that is young and has a big stake in this and doesn't really realize it. We have to make our message as cool as an iPod. We have to make it as, you know, as sexy as that to get out there. And I think something like the Where's My Bailout video that my colleague Ted and his wife Courtney put together. I thought that was a great approach for doing that, getting our message out there in ways that are crafty, hip, trendy, and we have to make it sexy. We have to make markets sexy again.
Well, I do have to say, in terms of speaking to the public, I mean, this bail, I mean, the American public is one of the groups that actually is right about this bailout. And you see, like, by most polls, 80% of the American public is against this kind of bailout, and even, like, for the car industry that's coming up. Yet we just went through an election cycle in which they largely reelected their incumbents without their position on the bailout being a real factor in the election. So if you've got 80% of the public thinking the bailout's a bad thing, yet don't vote on it, I mean, how much traction can we really get by just speaking to the American public?
I don't know.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I don't either.
Just talk to me. I believe you. You convinced me. But, I mean, I just don't know. I just think that it's time. And I think, actually, no matter how down I am on all this entire thing, I think it is a tremendous opportunity to actually, you know, just be hardcore, as hardcore libertarian and free marketers as we can now. We have nothing to lose, and we're right. And so, and plus, there's so much work for us. Like, each time someone says deregulation, you have something to say. You can write an op-ed, and you can free ride on this entire crisis by making your career out of it. But you're right. I mean, it's just, who do we talk to? Maybe I should get a column with L or something.
I will say, I do want to open up for questions. I mean, we do, the best thing about this moment right now is we have a moment of clarity.
Yes.
And you can't win a battle unless you know what battle you're fighting. And I think for a long time we didn't really understand what battle we were fighting. Now we know what battle we're fighting, and it's a pretty extreme one, and it's a pretty basic one. Tim?
Is there, I think there's ammunition in saying, what we've seen in the last couple of years is a period of contraction after a massive expansion. Basically, the economy doing what it's meant to do. I mean, mm-hmm. Finding, accurately pricing assets. And and I think that's actually an easily sellable point. I think a lot of people understand that. And I mean, everybody you talk to, there was nobody in 2005 looking at home prices and saying, these things don't seem inflated at all. It seems like, there really is $750,000 worth of value in that two-bedroom house. Nobody thought that. And, it's like any bubble. And I've been at the forefront of at least one bubble in the dot-coms. Everybody knew it was going south. People knew in 1999 this whole thing's coming to an end. And, you never know when it's going to end. But I think that's an easy case to make.
Plus, people are not always against price going down. Like, you take the entire female community, when the prices of shoes are going down, you're like...
Exactly. When is the
same thing for houses.
We're actually all happy when the price of women's shoes go down.
I really, you're a shoe fetish.